welcome to episode 2 of The Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. I've been working as a match commentator on radio for over 20 years now. And every commentator I meet, whether it's radio, TV, old, young, male, female, experienced, inexperienced, we all have different tales to tell about how we got there and how we stay there one way or another. And there's so many different routes that people take. We do have an archive that was starting to build up. In episode 1, I chatted with Ian Crocker of Sky and Guy Mowbray from the BBC. You can discover that if you look back on your podcast history in our archive. But let's get on with episode 2. I've got two more great guests with me to have a little chin wag for an hour or so. First up is an old colleague of mine who our paths didn't cross in the very early days of my time at BRMB and Capital Gold, because by this time he'd gone to the fledgling Talk Sport. He's one of the originators of the days of Talk Sport, and he's still there along with me over 20 years on. Nigel Pearson's with us on The Commentator's Curse. Nigel, how you doing?
Hanging on in there, Dan. Surviving by the end of my fingertips.
Which is a familiar response that you'll get from any commentator. Nigel, lovely to speak to you. And also with us, I'm delighted to say, joining us from the other side of the pond, where he's not long transferred his life and his work, working now for ESPN on Premier League commentaries, but also on Major League Soccer. John Champion is with us, who used to work for BBC and ITV. John, it's a delight to have you with us.
It's great to be with you. Like Nigel, I'm sort of hanging on in there by my fingertips.
We should first of all just make sure that we know geographically where you are, because I know where Nigel is. He's in the middle of the Black Country somewhere, but you are in the middle of the United States.
I am. I mean, there's a lot of the United States to be in the middle of, but I'm in Columbus, Ohio, so I'm doing a game in Major League Soccer between Columbus and Cincinnati, which is actually a local derby. There's only 100 miles between the two of them, which is next door neighbours in the terms of geography here. So Columbus, it's my first visit here, and it's a bit like Middlesbrough without the charm, I would say.
Well, it's 100 miles apart. That is the MLS equivalent of the Dundee derby, I imagine.
It is. I mean, these virtually next door to each other. The people here can't believe that two teams can be so close together. And yet, Cincinnati travelled here last night by bus, which is a rarity, because everything's air travel for the teams here. Yeah. And it took them an hour and a half on a bus. So it's almost like being back in England.
But home for you is much further east than that. You actually live on the eastern seaboard, don't you?
I do. So I live in a little town. I mean, everything's a town in America. It's either a city or a town. And I live in basically part of Boston, but it's called Brookline. And, you know, keen-minded listeners might remember Brookline because it was where the Ryder Cup was played about 20 years ago. It was the one that nearly ended in a fight on the course, the Battle of Brookline, as it's now known, and where the US Open is going to be played, I think, next year as well. So it's a little area of Boston, about 3 miles out from the middle. But Boston is a lovely place to live. I've really enjoyed it there.
You've not long gone out there. It strikes me on the face of it as being a really gutsy step that you've made at this point in your career, when you've already done so much as a broadcaster. Did it feel like you were taking a plunge? Did it feel like a journey into the complete unknown? Or was there a certain surety about the decision you took?
It wasn't made in haste. And it had been something that I'd had the option to do for about 5 years before I actually took the plunge and accepted the offer to come over here with ESPN. So briefly, I did the World Cup in 2014 for ESPN, the American side of ESPN in Brazil, and had a fantastic time. And it sort of was reasonably well received. And off the back of that, a couple of the sort of big shot American executives happened to be in London a few months later. And they took me out for lunch and said, hey, we'd really like you to come over here and call our matches over in the United States. Will you do it? And I've got four now largely grown up kids, but it just wasn't right at that time. It would have been too disruptive to their education. So I said no, but I would certainly consider doing it in the future, because it had been a real eye-opener coming and working for an American broadcaster, completely different in their approach, much more lavish in the way that they sort of set everything up. I mean, to give you a very brief example, when we did that World Cup in 2014, you'll appreciate that the broadcasters in Britain, the BBC and ITV that do the World Cup, always look for a great location for their host studio set. And I mean, both of them, I think, bought a little beach hut on Copacabana, and that was it. ESPN came along and paid $13 million and bought a yacht club. So it gives you that. That was the first thing that opened my eyes to the difference of scale in terms of how American broadcasters do it. So anyway, to cut a very long and slightly dull story short, I said no the first year, and then it became almost an annual event that these guys would take me out for lunch in London and say, "Will you come this year?" And yeah, I'd quite like to, but no, I'm not ready. And then in about 2018, it happened again. And it was at a time when there was a big switch from linear TV here to streaming. I mean, streaming is further down the road here than it is in the UK at the moment. So all the new broadcast contracts are being signed, even the NFL, which is the equivalent of the Premier League here in terms of the size and monetization of the deal. The deals going forward are now basically streaming with a little bit of conventional TV thrown in. So we've flipped things. And ESPN were signing a lot of football or soccer contracts for streaming. So it became a good time to go. We only had one child who was 16 who would have to move. The other three could continue their lives in the UK. So I just said, yeah, why not? And I'd done the job in the UK very happily for 35 years, radio and then TV. I started when I was 18. And I just fancied doing something different because whatever job I did in the UK, I would be doing something that I'd done before. And whilst it's great and the Premier League is fantastic and all the other things that we get to do, I just fancied on my CV at the end, when I finally, you know, turn in my cards and my lip mic, having something there that maybe not many people have done. So it's a challenge in your mid-50s to come to somewhere where the broadcasting is very different, the football is very different, life is very different, because I don't think you appreciate how foreign America is until you actually live here. So it's made me have to think, rather than just doing things almost on autopilot, I've had to go out, learn a new league, meet new people. And it's been fabulous because it's made my brain a bit more active again.
Well, Nige, you and I and John, we're all the same sort of age. I've never had anything thrust into my lap the same way John's had. I don't know about you, and you've had Nige, a very varied broadcasting career with what you've done in this country on radio and television in different sports. Nothing's ever been thrust your way quite the same way that John's had, have you?
No, absolutely not, Dance. And I think it's a wonderful story, John's. I think it's inspirational in many ways. I have done a lot of travelling, but I've retained my base in the UK. I've travelled all over Europe. I've been to Australia, America, with commentary in various sports. But I've always maintained my base in the UK. And significantly, as you know, Dance, we have two young children. Eldest is 12, so, you know, we won't be moving anywhere soon because, you know, the boys are a vital part of their education. But I admire John's decision. I think it's wonderful and an inspirational story in many ways. By the way, I'm in Staffordshire, not the Black Country. Can we get it right, please?
All right. It's nitpicking. But the point's that there's a bit of a Yorkshire theme developing with this podcast already because having spoken to Guy Mowbray in episode one, who's very much a man of York. I've got two Yorkies here, although, I mean, John, you're a Harrogate man, or at least you were, I believe.
That's I was only born in Harrogate, Dance. I mean, Harrogate makes me seem very posh, and I'm not. But my mum's best friend was a midwife, so even though the family lived in York, this midwife said that she would deliver me and my brother when he came along a couple of years later. So that's the reason I was born in Harrogate. I then returned to York at the age of 3 days.
Gotcha. So it's definitely a York thing, but Nige, even though, I mean, you are very much, from your accent, a man of Yorkshire, you've lived in the Midlands and worked in the Midlands ever since I've known you, and that's way over 20 years.
Yeah, I started in 89 on BR&B Dance. I was 19 at the time. But I was born in York, not Harrogate. I was born in York at was Fulford Hospital in York. John will probably recall that. And I lived in a village called Thorpe Willoughby near Selby. Until I was 13 years of age, and then moved down to the West Midlands because my dad, who was originally from Cradley Heath, moved back down to the West Midlands with my Yorkshire mum and got work and got based back in the West Midlands. So that's how we ended up down in the West Midlands. But yeah, proud Yorkshireman, it's fair to say. I don't mind admitting that when I first moved down, things weren't easy at school. I went to the King Swinford School and some of the other pupils there didn't exactly make me feel welcome. I was an outsider from Yorkshire.
What was that then, Nigel? How old were you when you moved?
13. So, you know, I was a strong rugby league fan and they'd never even heard of it down in the West Midlands. And it was a very strong footballing school. I loved all aspects of sport, but I wasn't, you know, I don't mind. I think I've posted this on social media before. I don't mind admitting that I did not find it easy moving home at that age down to the West Midlands. I left so many friends behind in North Yorkshire at Selby, and it was a real tough start. And because of that, I think I've gone about things my own way ever since. Because, you know, I'm not saying I was ostracised or anything like that, but certainly I think one or two teachers could see that I was finding it tough. But it made me grow up very quickly, very, very quickly. And those days at the age of 13, 14, 15 are very impressionable times on youngsters. And I found it tough, Dan, so I don't mind admitting that. And that's probably why I've grown into quite a determined figure who likes to do things my own way, you know.
Kind of reflects on what you were just talking about as well, John, about waiting until your children were of a certain age where you felt you could make a decision as a father and as a husband, I suppose. But the 16-year-old lads come with you, is that right?
Yeah, he came for the first. So I've been out here over 2.5 years now. So he came as a 16-year-old, having just finished his GCSEs in the UK, and was then thrust into an American high school in Boston, which was a very different and interesting experience. He's now graduated from high school, so he's waiting to go to university back in the UK in Newcastle. He's actually deferring for a year because of the global circumstances at the moment. But I always thought, actually, when he moved out here, that he would probably end up going to an American university. But he's sampled life here. He's enjoyed it in the midst of a pandemic, but decided that he's glad to have had a taste of it. We'll come back here a lot in the future, but prefers to go and continue his education back home.
Well, good luck to him. I wish him well. It's tough times for anybody in further education, for reasons that are too long and involved to go into here when we're talking about the life as a commentator. I mentioned, obviously, the fact that you're both Yorkshire men. But obviously, Nigel, you have already said you actually started your broadcasting career on BRNB, which, for those who don't know, Birmingham's biggest commercial radio station and the country's second biggest commercial radio station behind Capital Radio in London. But when obviously over the years it's been bought out and expanded under different radio groups, but I guess when you joined in 1989, it must have felt a little, you know, not as big as it became.
It was just, I mean, I have to say the sports aspect of it was pioneering because of Tony Butler originally, and then George Gavin and Tom Ross, you know. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it as a listener. And I can honestly say, I mean, I used to listen religiously to BRNB Sport, sponsored by Brew 11 Best Bitter or Davenport's. And, you know, I loved it. And I thought George did a brilliant job on a Saturday afternoon. It was sport and music then. So he had reporters around the grounds. Whereas now Adrian on TalkSport gives scores, we played music. It was fantastic.
Did they have the klaxon?
No, the only WM type klaxon, that because the WM klaxon, it's a goal. That's BBC WM. All we had on BRNB at the time was a pretty poor impression of that, which was goal action first on BRNB Sport, and so I think that was a poor imitation really of the WM klaxon. But I lived the dream because I listened to George and Tom and. When I got the opportunity, it was massive. I started with Hales Owen Town versus Tranmere Rovers in the FA Cup on a phone line.
How did you get the chance, Nigel?
I recorded some demos on the old cassettes, TDKC 90s. So I did some demonstrations of football reports that I'd done off TV, basically. And George got back to me, gave me a call, and gave me an opportunity. I got a letter from Tony Atwater at Beacon Radio saying, thanks, we'll put you on file. And I never heard from Beacon again until they came to BRNB and took me away from BRNB a few years later. But George actually rang me up and said, how would you like to go to Hales Owen Tranmere? Because I was working as a local junior sports reporter at the time on the local paper, which I put in my letter to George. And he gave me the opportunity. And after that first game in the FA Cup, I got a game every week and occasional midweeks as well for BRNB from there.
So what year was that when you started working for BRNB?
1989. It was the FA Cup in 1989. And from then on in, I got to cover Aston Villa when Ron Atkinson was manager. Yeah. You know, it all escalated very quickly. And of course, now on a serious note, gentlemen, in the UK, those opportunities are less and less, aren't they? You know, we could talk all day about the demise of commercial radio sports departments, but I was lucky to come in at a time in radio where, you know, there were opportunities like that with various stations, and opportunities now that are less and less around the country with local radio stations that perhaps aren't so local anymore.
It seems like we've actually gone back to the mid-80s in some regards, in that independent local radio doesn't really exist as a force for match commentaries, and the local BBC stations hold the whip hand, as they used to. And you're right, Nige, you were part of that era when sports rights and the bidding for exclusivity that BRNB certainly went for as time went on, it just grew and grew and grew, but then it grew past a point where they couldn't afford it anymore.
No, absolutely. And it was very sad, because I actually loved listening to BRNB Sport, as I say. But also, I remained freelance all the time. First of all, I was still a sports reporter at the Stourbridge News and County Express, and then doing BRNB on weekends. But then there were other avenues that came in, like writing programmes for Speedway clubs and the old club call telephone lines. You remember the old 60p a minute?
Oh, I want to talk about that.
Coming up on this bulletin, live from Bescot Stadium, we're going to be speaking to the manager, Chris Nicol, you know, in about 6 minutes' time when we finally get there and you spend £3.60.
Well, yeah, well, halcyon days, salad days, you might say. For you, John, was it local radio first for you, or did you get a chance nationally?
No, local radio. So I fell into it at the age of 18. Radio York, first of all, played in a cricket match one day, because I was hopeless at school, academically flunked just about everything. Got as far as taking A-levels, took four, passed two. One of them was general studies, which all you had to do was read the papers and be aware of current affairs. I managed to get a B in that, an E in German, and bearing in mind the subsequent career, failed English spectacularly. So I was hopeless. It was nowhere near good enough to go to university or college. So I decided that I would go and get a job for 6 months and earn enough money to then go travelling for 6 months. And at the end of that year, I try and sort my life out. So I got a job at the British Lending Library at Boston Spa near Wetherby in Yorkshire, just stacking books on shelves, sort of getting articles from periodicals. This was pre-internet. For academics around the world, you'd have to photocopy the article, package it up, send it off to Australia or Malaysia or Russia or wherever it might be. It was terminally boring, but it did provide some money to go travelling. Now, one day I played in a cricket match, which was the only sport I could play even moderately well in York. And I got a few runs and I retired to the bar afterwards. And I was about 3.5 pints of Tetley's in when the payphone in the corner of the clubhouse rang. And it was the local radio station, the newly set up BBC Radio York, wanting to interview me about my fabulous innings that day. So fortified by the previously mentioned amount of Tetley's, I waxed lyrical about what had gone out in the middle that day, put the phone down again at the end, went back, had several more pints of Tetley's and thought nothing more about it. And about 2 weeks later, there was a phone call at home from a guy who was the newly appointed sports editor of Radio York to say, look, we're in a bit of a pickle. We're trying to set up a sports department. We've got no money. We need some people to report on a bit of football and rugby this winter. We really like the sound of your voice. You sounded very fluent. Well, you bet I sounded fluent after 3.5 pounds to tell this. Do you fancy doing it? So I thought, well, I've got nothing better to do with my life. And I had no direction to my life at that stage. So I said yes, and they would send me out at weekends with a ewer for interviews, and you would just file your pieces on the payphone at whatever sports club you were sent to, rugby or football. And it went well, and about 6 weeks later, the manager of the radio station rang up and said, do you know, we think you've got something here. Would you be interested in trying to make a career out of this? And I said, well, I would. I've got no better ideas. I'm really enjoying it. It seems quite easy. I'm just a bit concerned that I can't really come and join the BBC because they only took graduates at that stage, effectively. And I'm in no position to get on a degree course. So the guy said, well, look, it doesn't matter how bad the degree course is. Just get on one. And then that ticks that box for us. And go away, mature a bit. We'll give you work at weekends. And as long as you train on, you'll have a job at the end of it. And they were as good as their word. So I went off to a Catholic teacher training college in the outskirts of Leeds called Trinity and All Saints. And it was just about the lowest of the low in terms of academic rigor. I did a course called Communication and Cultural Studies with Public Media, which is a snappy title. It's probably just a media degree in the modern age, but there are elements of psychology and sociology to it as well. And then at weekends, I'd go out and report on things. And it went very well. And about 6 weeks before my finals, there was a phone call from a very prim and proper lady at the Human Resources Department at the British Broadcasting Corporation Broadcasting House, London W1. My name is Miss Johnson. Is that Mr. Champion? I said, yes, it is. She said, I'm calling you about the job. And I said, the job. She said, yes, the job. I said, you're going to have to enlighten me. No one's talked to me about any sort of... Well, has nobody spoken to you? There's a job. It's somewhere in the North Country, I believe. Leeds, I believe, is the name of the city. Sports reporter, BBC Radio Leeds. We put your name down for an interview on Friday, 3 o'clock. These are the questions that the interview panel will be asking you. And these are the answers we would like you to reproduce. Don't forget to wear a tie. So basically, it was a setup. So I turned up with a tie on, parroted the answers. I remember feeling very uncomfortable sitting in the interview room beforehand with the other candidates waiting to go in, because I was thinking, as long as I don't flunk this, I've got this job. So there's not a lot of point in you sitting here, really. And, you know, that's the way it panned out. And 6 weeks later, after my finals, I started work as a full-time BBC staff member at Radio Leeds. So that was me off and running.
I hope you sent her a bunch of flowers.
I don't think she would appreciate... I just got the feeling that Miss Johnson wouldn't really have appreciated a bunch of flowers. I don't think she had a great social life either.
No. She sounds like a laugh riot, I have to say. How big was this committee you were sat in front of?
Three people. It was usually... I think it was the station manager, the sports editor, and someone from personnel who was supposed to oversee fair play and make sure that nothing untoward happened in the interview process, but obviously failed miserably.
It's interesting what you say about the whole degree thing, because that's what I encountered when I was at Sixth Form College, and we had a radio station at the Sixth Form College, and actually BBC Radio 4 for Schools came to our Sixth Form College to do a show, and Terry Christian was the presenter, and I was the college presenter, and there was a producer whose name escapes me that came down, and I said, well, yeah, a career in radio would really interest me, and that's when she dropped the bombshell to me. Well, we only take graduates, and I had no intention of going to university at all at that point. I was only interested in being a rock star. I wasn't in the plans at all to be a university student. So I was actually really deflated by that. And the funny thing is, I didn't consider the route Nigel, you went down, going down the independent local radio route, where they didn't discriminate in anything like the same way. If you could construct a full sentence, you had the gig.
Yeah, I mean, mine was quite... I love that story that John's just told. I think that's brilliant. Mine was just literally demonstration cassette sent off to Beacon, WM and BRMB, do one game and then get the call to keep doing games weekend after weekend. No questions asked about my education or my background or anything like that. They knew I was already working in sports journalism, but always preferred broadcasting to the written word anyway. Funnily enough, now I'm doing more written work than I have for quite a few years, as well as the broadcasting. But no, it was very casual. It was just George calling me saying, you know, I enjoyed what you did last weekend. Here's a game for you this Saturday. No emails then, of course. No communication like that. So it was a phone call on a Tuesday. I think George always had a Monday off. And then on the Tuesday, the phone rang early afternoon and here's your game for the weekend. So it was happy days, really.
So how long did you spend, John, working for BBC Radio Leeds?
I did 18 months, and then I was lucky enough to be offered a job by Network Radio. So all the sport at the BBC was on Radio 2 at that stage. Radio 5 and 5 Live hadn't been born. So I moved down at the end of 1989. I was 24, moved down to London, lodged with an elderly great aunt in Eltham, South East London, and started work. And I mean,
Johnson, was it?
No, it was... It was a different world, though, because
if you're back 1 minute later,
No, I wouldn't have gone and lodged with her. It wouldn't have been a bundle of fun. But you know, my first month, I remember walking into the sports room, which was the office on the third floor of Broadcasting House, where all the sport was done. And in one corner was Christopher Martin Jenkins. In another corner was Peter Bromley, the great racing commentator. Ian Robertson, who did rugby, had his own desk. Then there was Peter Jones, the most magnificent radio commentator. Brian Butler, the football correspondent. I was walking in to see and meet all the voices that I'd listened to as a kid. So it was quite intimidating and very exciting. But for the first month, I didn't have to do anything. I shadowed. That was my role. So I would sit next to someone who was going to read a two-minute sports desk on Radio 2 and just watch them do it. And they wouldn't let you on air for a month. And then eventually you would get the most antisocial shifts. So it would be the Today programme, because that meant being in there at 4 o'clock in the morning And they, you would do the two sports desks on the Today programme, and then you would do the early morning sports desks on the Derek Jameson show on Radio 2, and then there was the opportunity to move forward and work with Wogan, which was great fun. And eventually they would trust you a bit more. About 6 months into being there, I had a big break because, I mean, I was still very green and wet behind the ears, but it was the Italian World Cup and John Inverdale was due to host it. But it clashed with Wimbledon. So he could only do the first bit of the World Cup. So I got flown out to host the 1990 World Cup for BBC Radio, which was just such a step change from anything I'd ever done before. And I couldn't believe what was happening to me. And then 18 months later, I was going to the Olympics in Barcelona. And then one day, Mike Ingham fell ill before doing a Swindon-Aston Villa FA Cup tie at the County Ground. And I got a panicked phone call at 12 o'clock at night. And my background in local radio was, I mean, we did everything, didn't we? So I'd done a lot of presentation, but I'd also done and particularly enjoyed commentating. But, you know, I wasn't going to force my way ahead of Peter Jones, Brian Butler. Alan Green was making his way at that stage as well, Mike Ingham. Until this day, when Mike Ingham fell ill, so I got this panic phone call, can you get yourself to Swindon tomorrow to do this FA Cup tie? And I managed to get there. And Martin O'Neill was the co-com, so I didn't have to say much. And it all went very well. And that was my bridge into getting more commentary work. So I then switched from hosting Sport on 2, which was just becoming Sport on 5, to then becoming one of the commentators out on the road. And I did that for another 3-4 years. And then I'm sure Nigel can reflect on this as well. We all need moments of good fortune and luck in this business to take the next step. I was the radio commentator the night that Eric Cantona jumped into the crowd at Crystal Palace. And listening at home that night was a guy called Jonathan Martin, who for years had been the overarching supremo of BBC television sport during their halcyon era. And they were looking for someone to come in and replace John Motson for a year because Motty was going on a sabbatical. So it was very much a temporary post. And I got the gig off the back of that. And then, as so often, that temporary post became a permanent post. So that was my move from radio to TV.
Wow, the kung fu kick that actually worked in your favour.
It did. Yeah, Matthew Simmons did me a bit of a turn.
Wow. Is there a particular break that you can pinpoint, Nige? You know, obviously, the majority of your time at BRNB was doing reports, but when did the commentaries kick in?
I did probably a handful of commentaries for BRNB, but that was at a time when Ian Crocker joined us from London. I know Croc was a guest on your podcast last week, wasn't he, Dance? So Croc was brought in really as lead commentator. And then I'd get the occasional one around the West Midlands. George had left by that time and Tom Ross had been put in charge of the sports department. And I had the opportunity to do 4 or 5 commentaries. But then, this is quite staggering. Beacon Radio, who wrote a polite letter saying, thank you, we'll put you on file. I took a call from a guy called Colin Wilshire, who was in charge of Beacon in 1996, saying, we want to revamp our sports coverage. It's mainly Wolverhampton Wanderers, it's Telford United, and it's Shrewsbury Town, and West Bromwich Albion games as well. So we need somebody to front our sports coverage. And, you know, it was a pretty easy decision to make in the end because, you know, although it wasn't a full-time sports editor's role, it was a well-paid freelance role where I would do all the commentaries on a weekend and midweek. And also, I'd be up and doing the breakfast sports bulletins on Beacon. I'd have to be in at 5:30 in the morning for a 6:30, 7, 7:38, 8:30, 9 and 9:30 bulletin before going home. So it was a bit ruthless when you were, say, somewhere north on a Tuesday night in February when it was freezing cold and you don't get home until 1 a.m. and then you're actually back up and in the office in Tetnell Road at 5:30. But that's really where I got the commentaries really kicking on in radio because of the move to Beacon Radio. And I had the opportunity then to present sports shows and also did drive time on the medium wave station, WABC. So that was fun. It was just experience after experience. And that was great. And then it led up to 2000 when TalkSport was born.
Yeah, well, we'll get to TalkSport and the fact that you are one of the originators. But the reason that I wanted you two, John and Nigel, together, particularly on this episode, when I was just researching, wondering, well, you know, who would work together as a duo. What strikes me about both of you is the sheer breadth of live sport that you've covered as a commentator. Nigel, everybody knows that you do Speedway, and I do want to talk about that at some point, and darts as well. You and I dovetail our work at darts tournaments for radio and television. And John, you were talking about, you covered the Olympics in Barcelona, but even more bravely, I have to say, and I don't know what possessed you to do it, you've done rugby union commentaries as well, the World Cup. What possessed you to do, that's a horrible sport to commentate on.
It's tricky. I mean, my background from being brought up in York was rugby league, like Nigel.
Yeah.
And one of my local radio duties was doing the rugby league show on Radio Leeds, which is a big thing because rugby league is so important to the sporting community up there, and also commentating as well. And then when I was at Radio 2, Radio 5, I used to commentate on the rugby league there as well. And so when I moved to the BBC TV, as well as doing Match of the Day, they got me to do the Challenge Cup rugby, which was great fun. And then when I moved to ITV in 2001, they thought, right, well, he's dealt with that funny oval-shaped ball and we've got the rights to the Rugby World Cup, so he can do that as well. So that was how I came to be given the Rugby World Cup to do. So 2007 in France was my first one of those, and it was a huge challenge. I mean, they were very good. They gave me a long time to try and learn the game as best I could. But ultimately, there are certain skills as a TV commentator you can bring to it, but you have to rely on having a good co-commentator to really guide you through the minutiae of the rules and the scrums and things like that.
Rugby league, the sport that you two love, has not ostensibly changed all that much over time. But every year in rugby union, something else comes along to do with rucks, mauls, what referee blows up for. Trying to keep on top of that, that would just give me a headache.
One of the best things that they did, though, was give you, even before you were allowed to use it in the broadcast, they'd give you the referee in your ear. And that was the keys to the castle, really, for someone like me that wasn't that familiar with rugby union, because you could then hear not just the match director, but also the referee explaining his decisions to the players. So you were able to feed off that. And the other thing ITV did that really helped me was there's a guy called Wayne Barnes, who is a QC in London, but he's also one of the world's leading rugby referees. And they just gave me time to go and sit with him at matches. And he would act as my commentator at, you know, Rosslyn Park seconds against whoever. And he would just sit with me and say, right, the referee's given this decision because of that reason. This is what you need to, you know, focus your attention on at a scrum or a ruck or a maul. And that was massively helpful as well in terms of just trying to understand how it all works. And tellingly, he would often say, right, the referee's given decision A for this incident. He could quite easily have interpreted it in seven other ways. So it's not an exact science.
And this is what I'm trying to put across in this podcast to any budding commentators that are listening to this, about the different disciplines and the different parameters that one uses as a commentator across different sports. I mean, I've not done as much. I mean, we might get onto the Olympics a little bit, but I've only ever done football, cricket and darts in terms of commentary. You're talking about rugby union there. Nigel, you've done darts, but Speedway, one of your first loves, you've run a Speedway club. You know, Cradley Heathens has been a huge love of your life. To get a job as a Speedway commentator on television must have been one hell of a moment for you.
Yeah, it was a dream move, really. And it came about in a very similar manner to the radio, really, back in 89. This was in 2001, when Sky had just signed Elite League Speedway in the UK from 1999. And I watched it, obviously, regularly and doing commentaries on radio. And I thought, you know what? Nobody at Sky even has an idea who I am and that I'm a massive Speedway fan. So what I did was I sent an email to the producer of the Sky Sports Speedway, whose name I got and contact details I got from one of the promoters in British Speedway. And I just sent him an email and just said, I'm on TalkSport this Saturday at Villa Park. I'm a huge Speedway fan. I have been since I was 6 years of age at the Boulevard with the Hull Vikings. And since then, I've supported Cradley at the old Dudley Wood. And I just said, listen to my voice, listen to what I'm doing on the radio. And if you feel that I could do a job for you in any way, shape or form, it would be a dream move for me. And then lo and behold, 2 weeks later, I got a call from him. and he gave me the opportunity to do some Sky Sports News commentaries live into Sky Sports News from a big meeting. It wasn't a full OB, it wasn't a 3-hour program, but I think I did commentary in 4 races, and unbeknown to me at that time, he was giving me a trial live on Sky Sports News from Ipswich versus Oxford at Foxhall Stadium. And then from 2001, he liked what I did there. He gave me a lead meeting, Eastbourne Bellevue, in April 2002. And then we shared the commentary. The late Tony Millard and myself sort of alternated for a few years before in 2008, they put me as the presenter and the commentator. So I was in studio with Kelvin Tatum in Vision, and I was also commentating with Kelvin Tatum. So I was a presenter and commentator on Sky Sports then. And now, since then, it's gone to BT. Now it's with Eurosport, the British League. And I've survived every era, so I'm still on that now, thankfully. So, yeah, it's been brilliant. But also, that's how the dart started, Dance, because Rory, the gaffer of the Sky Speedway, was also the man responsible for the darts coverage. And quite often at the Speedway, we'd have a chat about the darts. And we'd go back to the old days of Jockey and Eric and Cliff Lazarenko and John Lowe, when I was a kid watching on TV. And then one day he just pulled me. We were having a drink in London. Might have been an end of season Speedway beer or something. And we were just having a drink with the Speedway team. And Rory just pulled me to one side and said, you know, we're expanding. There's going to be more darts than ever before on Sky Sports. We're signing more tournaments. You know, we're just going from the World Championship, you know, 9 or 10 days of a World Championship. We're going from that to 10 days of Premier League, 10 days of World Match Play, you know, the Grand Prix in Dublin, the UK Open in Bolton. So all this was progressing. So they needed more than just Stuart Pike, Dave Lanning, John Gwynne and Sid Waddell. They needed other people. So they gave me that opportunity. And that was 2006. That was the last World Championship at the Circus Tavern. That was December 06. And here I am now still going. I got the World Cup of Darts in a couple of weeks' time on Sky Sports. So surviving there as well.
I mean, it's a great story, Nigel. I just wonder, my feeling is, and we, you know, what we do is so subjective in terms of some people love you, some people hate you. I would always maintain that doing a breadth of sport makes a broadcaster better. Would you agree with that? Would you say you've become a better commentator because you do work across more than one sport and you can bring techniques from other sports into it?
I think that's a great question, John. My wife has said to me previously, I should have put my eggs more in the football basket because I may have earned more money and done better. But here I am in 2021, in my early 50s. Now I don't regret a thing. And I enjoy every sport I work on. Football, darts, speedway. I know speedway is only a minority sport these days, but everybody's heard of it, haven't they? And the viewing figures are fantastic. So I don't regret it one little bit. And now the figures are going up because we're on Quest on a Tuesday night, which is free to air. And everybody's heard of the Bellevue Aces. Everybody's heard of the Wolverhampton Wolves, you know, so it's still got a following. No, I don't regret it. I still love what I do. I still get the occasional commentary for TalkSport. I still get regular games for TalkSport. And I'm still busy with the darts and speedway. Has it improved me? I think that's a tough one to answer. I think I'm pretty good at all three, but I would say that, John. I'm slightly biased. I think I'm pretty good at all three. And I back my own ability, which I think we all have to do, don't we? But Dance, you, John, we all have to back our own ability, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We all have to be our own harshest critics, but also our own biggest backers, I think.
Variety is the spice of life, isn't it? Yes. We are fortunate, the three of us, that we've been able to plough slightly different furrows. The basics of commentary are the same for every sport, the descriptive element, vocabulary, language. But when you're doing something like darts on the radio, and you've done that with me, Nige. Television commentary and radio commentary for that sport could not be more different because darts on the radio is very much more, not just he throws the dart, it lands in 20. He throws the next dart, it lands in 5. I think the darts commentary is all about the psychology of the game as opposed to where the darts land half the time.
Yes, agreed. And of course, there is a little trick of the trade for television because we have what's called a spotter and we don't have that on the radio on TalkSport. And the spotter basically was Eric Bristow. We have Keith Deller now. basically trotting out numbers in our headphones in terms of combinations that players have to go out to win the leg. So, you know, he's also doing that job for the benefit of the director and the cameraman. So Keith Deller, or Colin Lloyd, as we have on the team now on Sky, he will say, right, go down the board. He's going to start on treble 19. If he starts on treble 19, he's going to switch to treble 18, and then he'll go tops. But I cannot work that out in my own mind because I've never been a former player. If I sit in the commentary box with Wayne Mardle or Rod Harrington or Mark Webster, John Part, any of the players that I've commentated with, they don't need the spotter. They know exactly where the player's going. But that's a little secret. Some people say to me, you know, when they see me down the pub or whatever, how do you work those numbers out? How do you do it? And I just give them a wink and think it's all thanks to Keith Deller. It was always thanks to Eric Bristow. And so, yeah, that's a little trick of the, that's a little secret of darts commentary on TV.
I'm shattered to hear that, Nigel. I can't tell you how disappointed I am to hear that.
I can't take all the credit for mathematics. No, I can't.
It's very interesting what you say, actually, Nigel, about rights issues and how, you know, in terms of football, you know, John, you've moved from BBC to ITV and you had a bit of Satanta as well, if I remember rightly. You know, it's trying to be, as Croc said to me last week, being on the right side of the rights issues is never easy. But Speedway's relationship with TV and different broadcasters seems to have had a really checkered existence, Nigel. It sounds like it's last minute a lot of the time, it seems to me, from speaking to you.
Well, in 2016, I don't think there's any doubt that Sky Sports terminated their contract early for British Speedway, 2 years early. That was well reported, well documented. I just think they wanted to go in a different direction. BT Sport picked it up for 3 years. And I believe, it's my understanding, that BT would have been happy to continue doing it. But Eurosport came in. Discovery, Eurosport Events, Discovery, they have come in with a five-year package for British Speedway. But it's not been without its concerns for me because, of course, you have to look at it from my own perspective. I'm still doing Sky Darts commentary and I'm a very, very loyal person. So I was nervous when Sky gave up Speedway and it went to BT. BT was straight on to me. We want you on the Speedway, please. So I had to then check with Sky that they were okay with that. And thankfully, my line manager in multi-sport at Sky was great and said, look, you know, you working for BT on Speedway won't affect your darts commentary on Sky. But it wasn't without its concerns.
It's good that you actually asked the question, though, Nigel. There'd be a few people that would just plough on regardless. But, you know, moral compass to at least ask the question.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk about balancing sports. Like John just mentioned there was the one great time when I did a commentary for Talk Sport at the Emirates at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
Our favourite time of the week.
I did the 90 minutes commentary, that's right. And then Sky had arranged for a motorbike to collect me outside the Emirates to get me from the Emirates to Isleworth for an on-air time of 6 p.m. for the Swedish Speedway Grand Prix off tube. So I had to hang on to the back of this motorbike. Ironic, really, because I was going to cover Speedway. But I did the 90 minutes at the Emirates, got off air at 5 o'clock, got outside the Emirates to just get a helmet on, gloves, and go on the back of a bike to be taken to Isleworth Sky Sports Studios to do the Swedish Speedway Grand Prix 59 minutes after I left the Emirates Stadium. I mean, that was a close call.
I've done a courier bike before when Birmingham won the League Cup.
Yeah.
To get from Wembley back to Talk Sport to do a phone in. And that was an hour, but that was weaving through, you know, Regent's Park, I seem to remember. And
You couldn't have done it in a car. No chance in a car.
The bike was delighted. He was a Spurs fan, so he was chuffed for me just for the fact that Arsenal had got beat. But that was pretty hairy, even though I was in a state of total euphoria, given what had happened. To be on the back of a bike that is showing no mercy to traffic around it was quite a moment. But, John, Olympics, and what sports did you cover when you did the Barcelona Olympics, for example?
My responsibilities were the aquatic, so mainly the swimming and a little bit of the diving, and also the ceremonies, so the opening and closing ceremonies. Those were the other things that I did. So I did three Olympics in the end, Barcelona, then Atlanta, then Sydney was my last one. And they were great. You get such a feeling of the world coming together. You obviously, you get that at World Cups, but you get it to an even greater degree, I think, at Olympic Games, just because so many more countries are involved. So that was one of the great thrills, really, doing that. And also doing the Commonwealth Games. I did a couple of those, and they were really nice, friendly events as well. So I just feel that, in my case, I can only speak for myself, but the breadth of events that I've done, I think, has probably, I hope, helped me as a football commentator, just because different nuances, different techniques, you know, different pace of delivery. Best job I ever had was probably doing the cricket on Test Match Special for 3 years. That was probably the biggest thrill of all, actually, getting to do that. But I think all of those experiences feed into what, in the end, in my case, became my bread and butter, which is the football.
I was intimidated doing cricket. I only did it a couple of times for TalkSport, and the last time was at the Champions Trophy in 2017. We shared rights with Five Live for that. And to be sat with players like Ramiz Raja and Sir Clive Lloyd, you knew that you simply could not put a foot wrong, because that, you know, that there are so few non-cricket broadcasters in cricket. It's pretty much a closed shop where it's ex-players. And to have an opportunity to call those games, like the final against India and Pakistan, which was a brilliant, brilliant final at the Oval. But it was very intimidating for me, knowing that I had to get the delivery right, because it's a totally different syntax to football, but also engage my commentators in a way that they knew that I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think I was lucky in that I was doing this 20 years ago, when there were more non-cricketers involved in cricket broadcasting at that stage. So I was in a commentary box with Christopher Martin Jenkins, Henry Blofeld, Jonathan Agnew, people of that ilk. Now, you know, Agger's clearly a former professional cricketer, but the other two weren't. So that wasn't the sort of trailblazing element. The trailblazing element for me was just the fact that I was about 30 years younger than anyone else in the box, really.
Yeah, always a bonus. Nigel, one of your highlights, I would imagine, as a football commentator, was going out to Germany in 2006 for TalkSport as one of the lead commentators on their coverage out there.
Yes, it was brilliant, Dance. You know, I mean, I had the opportunity there because I wasn't commentating on darts at the time, and I wasn't the full-time Speedway commentator on Sky. So, you know, I was doing a heck of a lot on TalkSport. So to go out to Germany, that campaign, I hosted the TalkSport World Cup final breakfast show from a hotel room in Berlin with Mike Parry. Liam Fisher, who's one of the main men at TalkSport now, was actually the producer of that show that day. We had a great time. I was based in Berlin for the majority of the tournament with Rodney Marsh. So, you know, we had meals together on a daily basis. We had drinks together. And, you know, he was brilliant company. He was wonderful company. Loved to tell a story. Great on the microphone. Great to work with on TalkSport. And it was just real pleasure to be involved in. I did an early England game against Paraguay on a boiling hot day. Did a full commentary on that. So it was great. But my role was varied there because I was doing commentaries and also hosting shows. So, you know, it was a nice varied role that meant that I was involved with the majority of the World Cup, but also Sky paid for flights to get me back on a Monday for Bellevue versus Arena Essex Hammers, and then fly back on the Tuesday morning to Germany. And that happened about four times throughout the tournament because the TalkSport management, they agreed to work with me around those dates. So although I did the majority of the World Cup, I was still doing three or four Speedway events at the time, flying back and commuting, and I still managed to avoid seeing my wife for a whole month.
but you did come off one of those airplanes in a wheelchair because your gout cropped up, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. Oh, that was remarkable. That was a Champions League tie, actually, in Turin. And Robin Schoenhofer, Rodney Marsh, and Steve Hodge, part of the management, were on that trip with us. And I'd suffered from gout quite a bit before, thankfully, I got it under control with tablets. But if anybody
less
wonders
Guinness.
What...
And less yeah. Guinness, Nigel. That's what's
happening. Well, I've gone the other way now, though. So when... when people wonder what gout is, it is not pleasant. The pain is horrendous. Many who've suffered and have broken bones have said the gout is actually worse pain. You know, it's a name that has humour around it, but it wasn't fun that day when I had to be taken onto a plane on a wheelchair and then to be escorted off the plane in a wheelchair and taken to my vehicle, which thankfully was automatic, which enabled me to drive home from the airport. So, and it was quite embarrassing, actually, and I just hated every minute of it, didn't want to be there. And a week after that touring trip, I was bedridden, basically, because I could not, literally, apart from hobbling to the toilet, I couldn't get out of bed because it was that painful. It was red, the foot and the knee were red raw, throbbing. And it's a form of arthritis because I still do get strong pains in my right foot and my right knee during the cold winter months now. And that's been brought on by gout, no doubt.
Well, I'm glad you've got it under control. I mean, when we get to, I mean, we all know as commentators what winter months are like on those press boxes. It's unforgiving. No amount of thermal underwear will save you.
No, absolutely. Temperatures we have to put up with
now these days. Now, I don't really see these heated gilets that some of our are favouring. I blame Danny Higginbottom for this. He started this.
Ian, you're talking to two Yorkshiremen here, and you're talking to us about heated gilets. Are you serious?
Danny Higginbottom, he was the first I remember to have a heated gilet under his jacket and coat, and it, the trickle has become a flood, I'm afraid to say. There's heated socks, heated gilets, and one commentator, who shall remain nameless, has a heated mat on which he stands in his stocking feet. He takes his shoes off so that he keeps his feet warm whilst he's commentating on a heated mat.
Ian, three words. The game's gone.
Now, that's a phrase that Nigel and I are very used to.
We are indeed. And there's a story as well, fellas. Do you both, I presume you both, you will know him, Dance, for sure. Do you know John Curtis from Press Association Freelance?
Jason.
He took a heater, a small heater, and I think this was at your place, Dan, St Andrews, and he plugged this heater into the press box and caused a power outage in the press box so nobody could work, all because he plugged in a heater, a portable heater, just to try and keep his feet and legs warm on a cold winter's night. Great story.
You should know better than to try and add anything to the power surge at St Andrews. We had Guy talking last week about causing a floodlight failure at Grimsby by trying to mesh two wires together so we could get a commentary line going. And now, I do remember, I don't think I was at St Andrews that day, but I seem to remember something similar happening at Villa Park when somebody spilt a cup of coffee over a heater. And of course, it caused everything to short out. And I think Brian Dugan, who was the press officer at Villa, banned heaters for a while after. But they still exist. Our colleague Jeff Peters has a rather large portable heater that he takes with him wherever he goes. It's more common than you think, you Yorkshire lads.
Disappointing, that's what it is. Very disappointing.
Well, one thing that, John, you became famous, infamous for 3 years ago was the partnership you forged with Ali McCoist in Russia at the World Cup as a commentary duo. Ali's since had a similar flood of interest and love, and with his partnership with Clive at the Euros that have just happened. But sometimes a commentary partnership just falls into your lap that just probably just feels like nirvana. This is it. And I've got the feeling that's how it must have felt to you working with somebody like Ali when you talk like Ivan the Terrible in the midst of a commentary.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed to work. I mean, my liver's only just recovered from that experience. and then annually, Amazon tend to get us back together at Christmas time for some Premier League games. So, again, my liver is assaulted. And we do meet up occasionally. I mean, I'd known Ali for over 20 years. We first worked together on the World Cup of 1998 for the BBC. But he was a studio pundit and I was just out on the road as a commentator. But we both fondly recall the BBC's pre-tournament party on a barge on the River Seine in Paris, where we both got stuck with Jimmy Hill in the corner of this boat. And after 2 hours, it was just a question of which of us were going to throw him overboard. so we've always got on well. And then we worked together at ITV, but again, him in the studio and me as a commentator in 06, I think, and probably 02 as well, those World Cups. So it was a bit of a surprise to both of us when we were thrown together as a commentary partnership for the World Cup. But it did seem to work. And I think we probably just benefited from a realization on both our parts, me particularly, that having done a lot of World Cups and a lot of major events over the years, I think early in my career, I probably tried too hard, you know, to make an impression and to try and do it to the best of my ability. And I think as you get a bit longer in the tooth and a bit more experience, perhaps that departs from your makeup. And I probably benefited a bit from that. And being alongside as someone as relaxed as Ali and someone who's determined to have fun, it just kind of worked. I mean, all this business about the historical, cultural, geographical perspective that we supposedly brought to the coverage of that tournament was entirely accidental. There was nothing pre-planned about it at all. We'd just resolved that we're going to go there and have a good time. And then I think it was the first game that we did, our opening fixture, and suddenly Ivan the Terrible came out of left field and we were kind of off and running. We'd been out for a walk that day, pre-match, and out for a spot of lunch, and we walked through a cemetery, and there was a famous philosopher's gravestone in the cemetery, and suddenly Ali brought him into the conversation as well halfway through the match when a player was down injured. So he was in the mood for mischief, but it did set the tone. And I suppose once people had responded positively to that, we mined that same seam of fun.
I can attest, dear listener, that John's liver was severely tested on that trip. I remember bumping into you and Ali in Sochi later on in the tournament. I think it was after the... Did you do Russia-Croatia?
When we did, the quarterfinal, yes.
That would have been the game when the Croatians knocked the Russians out on penalties. Yeah. And there was a bar about half a mile away from the Fisht Stadium in Sochi where I came upon John and Ali, and I think Mark Lawrenson was there as well.
Yes.
And some others who were getting stuck in to the local offerings with great gusto. And it was actually... I couldn't catch up with you. I was too far behind by the time I'd arrived. A great night was had by all.
It was. And there were a few of those during the World Cup as we travelled around. Because he seems to have friends everywhere. I mean, and the other thing is, he's got this extraordinary WhatsApp group. So you'd be sitting in the back of a bus at dead of night and thinking, you know, all I want to do is sleep. And of course, he's hyperactive. And he's there on his phone on this WhatsApp group. And, Jimmy, how are you? And you think, Jimmy Nesbitt. You know, he's just got his contacts list must be extraordinary, because if you could draw up a list of the sort of 200 best known people that came into your head immediately, I'd guarantee that at least 100 are on his contacts list on his phone. And he's just having a chat to pass the time with someone world famous.
No wonder him and Gascoigne got on so well. They're using apart, aren't they, in terms of their hyperactivity?
They are. He's a great man.
Is there anybody nice that you particularly loved working with, or maybe were intimidating working with? You mentioned Eric Bristow earlier, of course, who's sadly no longer with us from a darts perspective.
Yeah, I mean, Eric obviously springs to mind. He was what you saw with Eric was what you got. In terms of my football career with Talk Sports, so far, I love working with the current crop of co-commentators. I've got to say that a guy you were with regularly is brilliant, Perry Groves, always great to work with. We've got some very, very talented summarisers, co-commentators on TalkSport at this moment in time. Very early on, I commentated with Mickey Quinn, and, you know, Quinny with his humour, but also his opinion on what has just happened on the field of play. And I have to say, Rodney Marsh over the World Cup in 2006 was excellent. He was going around in years before then doing stage shows with George Best, an evening with Best and Marsh. And, you know, we went around Germany and he was telling me some of the stories of those stage shows. But when he came to the commentary, you know, he was deadly serious and gave a good, honest opinion. He wouldn't sit on the fence. You know, he'd say, I don't know what the referee's doing there. What on earth is the referee doing? Or, you know, I remember when we went to Northern Ireland versus England when they beat us at Windsor Park.
Yes.
And Rodney was there with me, and we went into the press conference afterwards. And basically, Rodney opened up speaking to Sven and just said, were you out-coached there? Have you been out-coached by Northern Ireland? I'm thinking, Rodney, that's a proper line to open up with. So I enjoyed Rodney. So Stan Collymore as well. Mm. Stan gave some very articulate views. There were some weekends when, you know, some of the games weren't the best that we were at, and sometimes I felt we were struggling on occasions. But on the whole, Stan was excellent and very good to work with. So in terms of there's two people that stand out in my career in other sports. I have to mention the late, great Sid Waddell in the darts. I still feel proud and honoured that for 6 years I was able to sit next to Sid Waddell in a commentary box at the darts, because he, in my opinion, if there's one man, apart from Phil Taylor, that has really grabbed the attention of people for a new era of darts, it was Sid. His voice was remarkable. But let me tell you, also as a person, my first ever day on the Sky Sports darts team, I was absolutely terrified, because I to work with these legends, Dave Lanning, John Gwynn, Sid Waddell. Stuart Pike had just joined a couple of years before. But Sid actually came over to me, and this was at the Circus Tavern before I'd even done my first match. And I was absolutely terrified, a bag of nerves. And Sid came over and put his arm around me, and he said, "Don't you worry, kidda. 3 years' time, you and me will be doing the world final." And he made me feel $1 million, and that was brilliant. And then I have to say, in Speedway, my old mucker, Kelvin Tatum, MBE, as I always have to add, those three letters on the end. He says, "Do you know what it stands for?" I said, "Go on." He says, "My bloody effort." So, yeah, Kelvin was a terrific rider. He won the World Cup with England. He was British champion twice. He was three times world long track champion. And he is probably the most articulate former professional sportsman, particularly in motorsport, that I have ever had the pleasure of working with. And we are genuine friends. And in Speedway, you might have noticed on social media, Kelvin and myself, pre-COVID, used to go out in the winter and do Tatum and Pearson tour nights and talk to fans about what's behind a TV broadcast and funny moments from Kelvin's career. And we're still working together now. In fact, this weekend, as we're recording this podcast, we have the Russian Speedway Grand Prix. And Kelvin and myself will be at Stockley Park doing an off-tube commentary for BT Sport and IMG World Feed. So, yeah, we're still at it today, and he's brilliant, Kelvin. Very, very intelligent man as well.
I love the structure of Speedway commentaries, where you cover the first two laps and then Kelvin comes in for about three quarters of the third lap and then you pick it up towards the end of the race. It's a structure that works really well.
Yeah, and we nailed that from the start, really. It was great. And, you know, the presenting as well, we hit all our counts, you know, end of the show, off air in 10, 9, you know, he'd say a summing up. And then when he heard there were 4 seconds left, he'd let me come in and say, "It's been a great night. Join us next Monday. We'll see you then." And, you know, it was just seamless. And I'm sure John can relate to things like that. You know, to have a partner like that was excellent. So, yeah, and still great to be working with Kelvin. And, you know, a lot of people don't like him. I think that is because of the fact that I'm talking about maybe his contemporaries from back in the day when he was racing, because he wasn't perhaps the most outgoing, flamboyant character. But all these years later, you know, he's successful as a broadcaster. And, you know, he deserves great credit for that. And it's very well deserved.
I agree. I don't really see a problem with Kelvin. I think that the team that you two have struck up, and the fact that you're still working together and you are paired together by different broadcasters, speaks volumes for how well you two dovetail with one another. Listen, we're running very short of time here. You know, we could go on for another hour talking about this. But John, just coming back to you for one final question to you. There you are, working in Columbus, Ohio tonight. It's MLS that's your bread and butter, but you are doing Premier League as well. Is it, having been on site for Premier League games for BBC and ITV for as long as you were, now to be doing it off a TV monitor, is it weird, or does it make no difference whatsoever?
Well, I don't really do much of the Premier League over here because ESPN don't have the rights. They're held by NBC. So the Premier League I do tends to be when I'm back in the UK from time to time with someone like Amazon, or maybe for the Premier League for their worldwide broadcasts. So the majority of what we do over here is actually on site at MLS stadiums, which is nice. It wasn't for 18 months. We weren't allowed. Our parent company is Disney. They wouldn't let us travel because of, you know, COVID is a different thing here in many ways, in that the United States has never come to terms with dealing with it. So it's been a lot more rife and rampant in various states. I'm staying in a hotel now. No one's wearing a mask. No one's paying any attention to COVID, and it can be quite frightening. So anyway, for those reasons, we weren't allowed to travel. But now we're back on the road, have been for the last 6 weeks. I mean, last week, I did a game in Los Angeles on Friday night, Los Angeles Galaxy. And then that finished at about 11 p.m. Pacific Coast time. By 12:30, I was at LAX, the airport, battling through still enormous crowds to get on a plane to Minnesota. And then I called another game 14 hours later, 2,000 miles away. So that was a career first, because, you know, I've done Premier League games. I remember doing one at lunchtime at Stoke for the Premier League, and then another one for BT at Everton on the same day at maybe 5:30 that same Saturday afternoon. But that's about 50, 55 miles in between. This was 1,925 miles. So I cast myself into the arms of Delta Airlines and hoped for the best, and we made it. So there are different challenges, but there are lots of really, really good venues over here. You know, a lot of new football stadiums that have been built specifically, rather than playing in an old NFL stadium, which used to be the way of it in Major League Soccer. This ground we're going to tonight in Columbus, 25,000, only opened 6 weeks ago. So that's very much the future. So it's nice to go to different arenas, really.
Yeah, well, when I was over in Miami pre-World Cup 2014, when England were out there, I went to the Miami Marlins baseball stadium, which is an indoor baseball stadium.
Yes.
It cost them billions to build, and they can't fill it. They almost never fill it. But they still managed to justify lavishing these billions of dollars on an indoor baseball arena. I have to admit, the game didn't quite hook me in the way I hoped it might have done.
Baseball's in an interesting place here, because the average age of a baseball fan is somewhere in their 60s, so the demographic is not good. The average age of a football fan in this country, our code of football, is somewhere in the low 20s, so it's got a lot of room for growth.
As I'm sure you know, John, there's a lot more interest being taken in MLS, not just because of when Beckham went to Galaxy, but now you've got Inter Miami, Phil Neville. And you do get the sense that MLS is growing in terms of, it's not just a home for soon-to-be-retired footballers. It is becoming a more important cog to help the US men's national team as much as anything else.
Yeah, and the model's changed. So instead of aging Europeans, it's now young South Americans that feed this league. It's being touted to good young Brazilian and Argentine players as a staging post to Europe. And also, they've now got an academy system. All the clubs have academies. So they're not reliant on the American college system to spit players out at the age of 22 or 23 when they finished their degree. And frankly, it's too late for them to develop a proper professional football career. Now those academies are allowing people to make their debuts in the first team at 16 and 17, which is why you're seeing more good young American players moving to Europe now.
It's a lot of prep there. That's a lot of prep.
That's the spiel, anyway.
Yeah. Well, Nigel, with what you do, you mentioned you do a lot of writing as well as a lot of broadcasting. What's your role as a press officer with regard to Speedway? Because I'm trying to remember what your role was or is.
Yeah, basically, I've got another string to my bow is an agency for Speedway media output and program compilation and editing. And I'm working with a company called Curtis Sport, who now do Celtics program. They do Newcastle United, Norwich, Birmingham, West Brom. And basically, I oversee the editorial side of those programmes and media output for various clubs around the British Speedway scene, sending to local papers, radio stations, organising social media coverage of various clubs. And I've got guys working for me on a subcontract basis, young guys who are doing that as part of my business. So, that's enjoyable. I'm not very hands-on with that, although I do write quite a bit for programmes, and I do a bit for local newspapers, that type of thing, as part of the agency. So, that's what I am in terms of away from the track, away from the microphone, if you like. And it's an aspect of work that I'm enjoying. And I mean, I'm actually enjoying going back and writing columns and going back to how I started in journalism back in 88, 89 with a written word.
Kind of coming full circle, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm also maintaining the broadcasting as much as ever before. I'm keeping busy. So, yeah, it's great. And still working in three different sports in broadcasting. I'm at Wolves Manchester United on Sunday for updates for Chalk Sport. Russian Speedway Grand Prix Saturday from Stockley Park for IMG, which is taken by BT. And then on Monday night, we have Wolverhampton versus Bellevue Aces live on Eurosport. So this weekend, I'll be on BT Saturday, TalkSport Sunday, and Eurosport on Monday.
It's enough to make your head spin. And that's on this side of the pond. Never mind a 2,000-mile flight to make in 14 hours, like John just had to do. That's a that's one to set the cogs whirring in your brain. Listen, gents, but we're out of time. As I say, we could spend so much longer chatting. Just one final question to each of you. Anything, any mountains left to climb? Anything that you feel is left to achieve that you haven't quite managed so far in your broadcasting career? I'll start with you, John.
I think longevity, actually. I'm 38 years in now, but I'm not at an age where I'm anywhere near wanting to retire. But I want, when I finish, I'd like to finish on my terms. So I'd like to find a point many years in the future when I can eventually turn my back on it and people say, oh, it's a shame he's decided to call it a day, rather than saying, thank God he's gone. So that's my aim now. I've been so fortunate to do so many things that I could never have imagined I'd have had the opportunity to do. So I suppose in answer to your question, I just hope that my luck holds.
Nigel, same to you.
Yeah, I think so. I don't regret a thing. I'd do it all over again. For the last 31 years, I'd do it all over again if I was given the chance.
Question, would you, if given your time again, would you have recommended to TalkSport that they take on this young lad Ian Dancer in 2004?
Well, 2004 was a long time ago, Dan. So, you know, I've had time to change my mind since then. But no, I'm delighted for you as well. It's been great to see how you've progressed with TalkSport, and I'm absolutely delighted because...
Dancer, you, yeah, I remember you ringing me and saying, Dance, they need a reporter.
Yeah.
They need a reporter in the middle. Yeah. Jeff Owens leaving. Get yourself in there, son.
Yeah, I know. Great times, and I don't regret a thing about that. And I'm very similar to John. I'd like to avoid the sack. I've never been sacked from anything. I would like to recognise when the time is right, but I also do everything for my family. This sounds very cringeworthy, but I want to be in a position where I am financially stable, financially secure for the remainder of the time that I've got left after I finish from working in this industry. And I want to make sure that there is enough in our family to protect my two young boys, who are 12 and 9, from whatever the world throws at them in the future. That sounds a pretty boring answer, but that's how I feel about life at the moment.
That's right.
No mistake at all.
Nige, lovely. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and all the best for all the myriad of different jobs that you do. And John, it's so lovely to speak to you on the other side of the pond. I hope this is not too early that we've got you out of your stinking pit to talk to us.
No. It was very civilised, actually. It's currently just after 11 o'clock in the morning. So
good.
It's after 11 is.
So you were also able to get to the breakfast buffet bar downstairs before you even spoke to us.
Well, absolutely. And let me tell you, the portions are not small.
True. John, continued success over there. Hopefully our paths might cross if you come back and do some Premier League over Christmas time and New Year, like you said you've done with Amazon before. John, thanks, mate.
Yeah, no, it's been great fun chatting, and to you, Nigel. All the best to you.
Take care, John.
Thanks, gentlemen. Nigel Pearson and John Champion have been my guests today on The Commentator's Curse. The archive's there, so you can hear the other episode we've done so far with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker. Thank you for your time. We'll be back soon with episode 3 of The Commentator's Curse.